Welcome and welcome back to the second of three talks this year by Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Ann Parker. They're expanding on the themes of their wonderful book, Saving Paradise, that's inspired our theme this year. If you missed yesterday's talk, I'm sure you can pick up a copy in the G bookstore. And also, there's copies of this book available. It's at a special festival discounted rate, so you can get down there to pick up a copy. I finished it earlier this year. It's a great read. And as Rita told us yesterday, even their critics say it's a must read. So, that's a sign of how good it is. And if you do pick up a copy and you want to bring it back to the talk, which the third talk, which will be this evening at 6:30 in Eden, they'll be more than happy to sign it for you. So without further ado, I'll hand over for this second talk. So if we can give a big green belt welcome to Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Ann Parker.
You want to start, then I'll talk, then you talk.
Yeah. All right. Good morning, everyone. I'm pleased to introduce to you my co-author and friend, the Reverend Dr. Rita Nakashima Brock. Rita is the director of the Soul Repair Project, centered at Bright Divinity School in Texas. It's a national project in the U.S., which may go global, that addresses the needs of those who have directly experienced violence for their souls to be repaired in the aftermath. You might say more about that. Rita and I have been friends since graduate school. When I first met Rita, I was a very serious, introverted, somber, religious person. And we were both in religious studies and theology, but Rita was having fun all the time. She liked to dance and to party and to hot tub. So for...
yeah. So that's because I skied and I was sore at the end of the day.
So for the many years of our friendship, she's been teaching me that a religious life also takes delight in life, which is one of the themes we'll talk about.
And I'd like to introduce my friend, the Reverend Dr. Rebecca Ann Parker, who was the first woman president of a theological school in the United States. And she's a professor of theology also. And our first book together was called Proverbs of Ashes. And in it we discussed our own difficulty with the theology of atonement that says the death of Jesus saved the world, and the ways it functioned in situations of domestic violence and sexual abuse and war to sanctify violence. So Saving Paradise is our positive answer to our critique in Proverbs of Ashes. And Rebecca and I actually bonded in graduate school, not so much around our love of theology, although we shared a similar kind of progressive theology, but really around our love of the arts and beauty. Mm-hmm. And I think you'll see that in Saving Paradise, that we've come back around to our original reason for bonding as friends and having been friends for 30 years.
So we'd like to invite you, as we come together, to take three deep breaths and fully arrive into this place. Feel your body on the chair and your feet on the ground, and let your awareness open to the presence of paradise here in our midst and in one another's company. So three deep breaths. We are all citizens of paradise. Would you turn for just a moment and introduce yourself and say hello to a fellow citizen of paradise? And then you can bring us back in.
If you can hear me, clap three times. Okay.
It's Saturday night, and Teresa Blainer is out with her partner, Doug, and their pet parrot, Gandalf. They're trying to salvage this forgotten corner of their Washington neighborhood.
That made-for-TV weed cutter, you know, the one that, like, the weasel, the garden weasel?
Teresa and Doug are guerrilla gardeners, citizen activists who transform urban landscapes by gardening in public places without permission. Call it graffiti with sunflowers and petunias.
I guess they chose the term guerrillas because just like with guerrilla warfare, you kind of get in and you get out quickly. We pick a spot and we come in without permission. We do what we have to do and we get out.
Except the cabbage, the kale.
Guerrilla gardening communities are popping up in major urban areas. London, Paris, Los Angeles. Gardeners blog about their garden graffiti, often done in stealth and under the cover of night. They often use the internet to vote for the location of their next hit.
This is probably the most run-down site we've ever done.
Teresa says tonight's location may have been a garage once, but it's appeared abandoned for more than a year.
This is an ugly spot, but it has a lot of potential.
I thought I found another condom wrapper. We've already uncovered three.
Kenneth Moore writes a home gardening blog in Washington. He says in guerrilla gardening situations, it's important to work with plants that can deal well with neglect.
The purpose behind guerrilla gardening is plant where it's not being maintained, plant where beauty would not otherwise occur.
That's what this is, beauty.
Oh, this is totally beauty. It's also vandalism.
I think we just all came out and just started planting whatever we had, and people try to be nice, like if you brought something, then you can kind of say in where you get to plant it.
Oh, what'd you bring?
I brought a butterfly bush and some irises and some kale. It smells like lilacs, actually, at night. I didn't even know that when I got it.
Guerrilla gardeners often choose high-profile locations to make an environmental statement, a sewer hole, or an abandoned newspaper box. But Teresa says her guerrillas prefer to create permanent urban gardens, which people and municipal workers cannot later destroy.
I don't like it when plants die. I like there to be a chance for those plants to make it, to give birth to little plants.
Guerrilla gardens are designed to engage with the community in which they grow. And Teresa's hideaway garden patch doesn't escape the attention of this 62-year-old Vietnam veteran who wants to know what's going on.
Oh, that's a beautiful gesture, too. Yes, indeed. That would be most beneficial.
If they can look and see that four people took this area in a couple of hours and transformed it into something beautiful, they really can do the same thing on their walk every day.
I'm excited for the coming months as they grow and next year when they come back to see what it looks like.
What do you hope it'll look like?
Beautiful. I hope for beauty.
It may not look like much now, but come spring, there will be tulips here where once there was only broken concrete.
I'm so excited. Can't wait to see it in the daytime.
DC Guerrilla Gardeners.
Teresa and Doug, Gandalf perched on his shoulder, hope their latest illegal urban garden will have a real chance to grow. They've probably broken city trespassing laws tonight, but they're not worried about the police coming after them.
We're the least of their worries. Saturday night in the city, I'm sure there's a lot more going on than gardeners, you know, planting things in the dark.
Mama Rabbi, VOA News, Washington.
So, garden is in the ancient texts of the church a word for paradise. And Rebecca's going to tell us about a poet of paradise from the 4th century.
The centrality of gardens and of the image of paradise as an organizing central spiritual image. It has ancient roots. And one of the most beautiful poets of paradise in Christian literature is Ephrem of Syria. How many of you have heard of Ephrem? Oh, this is good. A lot of people have forgotten about Ephrem, but in the 4th century, Ephrem was the most popular hymn writer and songwriter in the whole Christian world. And his hymns and poetry were translated into all the languages of the church in the 4th century. He wrote in Syriac, translated into Greek and Latin, and sung all throughout the Christian world for the next 4 centuries, the most popular hymn writer. He's still called affectionately by Eastern Christians who love Ephrem, the songbird of paradise. Ephrem lived in a city that was on the borderlands in the contested spaces between the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire. So throughout most of his life, his city was exposed over and over again to the violence of war and was laid siege more than one time. So there were periods of time when the people were cut off from water and from food. It was in this context, as a church leader, as a biblical scholar and exegete, and as a poet and hymn writer, that Ephrem worked. And even though the situations of his people were often very dire in terms of the violence of war and the deprivations of war, for Ephrem, the paradise garden was the organizing central theme of his theological work. And he spoke of the garden as, he said, that garden, he said, the paradise garden is the life breath of this diseased world. So that whatever we're experiencing, the balms, healing balms of the garden reach us and are available to us. They're present among us. He ended his life after the Persians had again conquered his city and his region. They let the people go free, and they went into exile to seek a new life in Turkey. He was, how old was he? 67.
63. Or something like that.
He and his community went into exile. He spent the last years of his life ministering to people who were experiencing disease and famine, and still he wrote more than 1,000 lines of poetry about paradise. And we want you to hear and meditate on these words that he wrote on the reading of the book of Genesis, the creation story in Genesis. "The verses and lines spread out their arms to welcome me. The first rushed out and kissed me and led me on to its companions. And when I reached that line where the story of paradise is written, it lifted me up and transported me from the bosom of the book to the very bosom of paradise. Paradise surrounds the limbs with its many delights, the eyes with its handiwork, the hearing with the sounds, its sounds, the mouth and nostrils with its tastes and scents. Paradise raised me up as I perceived it. It enriched me as I meditated upon it. I forgot my poor estate, for paradise made me drunk with its fragrance."
So, about 20 years ago, the feminist theological community in North America started talking about a term called erotic power. And David Carr, a Hebrew Bible scholar at Union Theological Seminary in New York, was inspired by the feminist work on erotic power to take another look at the erotic book in the Bible, the Song of Songs, because he got curious about where was this literature from and why had it been so neglected in Western Christianity. And he discovered in his research that the Song of Songs parallel of that kind of love poetry, that kind of wildly exuberant love poetry, occurs in Middle Kingdom Egypt as the closest parallel, which is quite old, older than anything else in the Hebrew Bible in its dating. And then he discovered that, of course, the Song of Songs is one of the most
popular books in both Judaism and Christianity until the period of the Enlightenment. And in fact, most major theologians of the church wrote, ancient theologians wrote commentaries on the Song of Songs and on the first three chapters of Genesis, which is very interesting. Those were the most commonly commented upon books of the Bible. Bernard of Clairvaux actually wrote 63 sermons, one on every verse of the first three chapters of the Song of Songs. So this is so it was a very popular book. And then as he began to think about the rest of the Bible, he suggests that the rest of the Hebrew Bible is actually a commentary on the Song of Songs as the first and oldest piece of literature. And so I want to engage us today in a thought experiment about thinking of the Bible that way, thinking of the Bible as a kind of commentary on this amazing, erotic Garden of God. So if you think about it that way, you could see Genesis 1 and 2 as explaining how we got the garden in the first place. So you have the story of creation with the Spirit of God breathed into the chaos and creating life and all of it being good, blessed. And then you have a special moment where there's a garden created for human habitation in which one of the main themes of that garden is it's not good to be alone. And so you have the creation of love in the garden, of human love in the garden, but also relationships to the animals as companions and then the relationship to the natural world as a place that's blessed but also dangerous because the serpent's in that garden and the serpent is also a creation of God. So you have this garden with dangers lurking. So it's really important in that garden to become wiser about how one lives in that garden. And then you have the story of the fall, which is how we lost the garden, how we were exiled from the garden by a failure to take moral responsibility. So that Adam and Eve, when they realized what they had done, rather than taking moral responsibility for what they had done, they each blamed somebody else. And you cannot live and sustain life in paradise if you can't be moral, if you can't take responsibility for your own conscience. So we lose the garden. So everything after, the fratricide, the wars, the disasters that accumulate through the rest of the Hebrew Bible are the story of what happens when you lose the garden. And the end of the Hebrew Bible, and Rebecca's going to talk more about this, where you get Ezekiel and some of the prophets talking about the restoration of the city of Jerusalem after the exile, you get the recovery of the garden, so that in the Hebrew order of the Bible, not the Christian order, but in the Hebrew order of the Bible, the way the Jewish order is, the last books of the Bible are the wisdom we finally get to after all of this disastrous stuff in between. We get to the moment when we begin to come to terms with our moral responsibility, and so the Song of Songs is in that section. So it's like the bookend to the story of how we got back to the garden was we became wise. And so you have next year in Jerusalem, you have the sense of Jerusalem is finally the city that's established with the healing trees and all of that. So if you think about it that way, you can think about the entire Bible as the story of the paradise garden and how to live rightly, humanity has to find its way back into it.
Can you read from the Song of
Songs? I'm going to read from the Song of Songs.
The Song of Songs is the place in the Bible where the word paradise appears. Paradise in the Song of Songs is the paradise garden is a place of abundance and beauty, of erotic joy. There's danger, but there's also pleasure in the garden. And we want you to hear these words. As my students sometimes say, that's in the Bible.
I'm reading this, the English translation uses words like orchard and garden, But in the Septuagint version of this, and in the Latin version of this, the word is paradise. So I think it sounds different when you put the word paradise back in. So I'm going to put it in here when I'm reading it. And this is chapter 4 of the Song of Songs, verses 12 through 16. A paradise locked is my sister, my bride. A paradise locked, a fountain sealed. Your channel is a paradise of pomegranates with all choicest fruits, henna with nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all chief spices. A paradise fountain, a well of living water and flowing streams from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind. Blow upon my paradise, that its fragrance may be wafted abroad. Let my beloved come to his paradise and eat its choicest fruits.
So the images you see cycling through as we're speaking about these themes from the Bible intersperse early Christian sanctuaries and images from our life now and the world we live in now. In the first centuries, first millennium of Christianity, when Christians began to build worship spaces that were permanent, the worship spaces were filled with images of the Garden of Paradise, the tree of life, rivers, birds, flowers and fruits, and the companions, the beloved companions to life, Christ at the center, but all the companions of the ancestors who are with us in paradise in this world. So as we're unfolding here, the way that the paradise garden is the earthly reality of God's grace and abundance, we invite you to keep looking at the images and let that bring you back and forth between those early Christian sanctuaries and the world we know now, world we see around us. One of the things we think is really important to understand about the centrality of the garden imagery and the importance of paradise in the biblical literature is that paradise literature is about our experienced reality of life's goodness. Let me say that a second time. Our experienced reality of life's goodness. The experienced reality of sexual pleasure and erotic pleasure in life, the experienced reality of good fruits, of wine, of bread, of olives, of cheese, the experienced reality of refreshing waters and of abundant land that sustains our life, the experienced reality of companionship and friendship, and the experienced reality of compassion and help in times of trouble, food for those who are hungry, and medicine for those who are ill. So for many of us, our framework that we come to the ideas of paradise is as something ideal or imagined, or something lost at the beginning of time, or something to get to after death. But in the Bible, paradise is the concrete reality of life at its best. And so it's the real. It's not the ideal. Paradise is the real. And you see this very vividly in the literature of the Psalms, which next to the Song of Songs and Genesis is a really important literature. The Psalms, the Psalm, "Oh, taste and see that God is good." So this invitation to experience the reality of blessing in this life, here and now, that's paradise. So the experienced reality of life at its best, even with its dangers, toils, and snares, and the temptations of the serpent in the garden, this experienced reality of life at its best is the foundation for the prophetic critique of life that has betrayed paradise. So in the prophetic literature, like the book of Amos and Isaiah and Ezekiel, the prophets of ancient Israel invoke the reality of life's goodness, of God's creation of a good world, as the foundation from which they criticize what is wrong. So that famous, we all know in Amos, where Amos calls for, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. He calls for justice and righteousness in the face of the way in which his community has been betraying the virtues of justice and righteousness, and such that the poor are going without bread and the rich are getting too much, more than their share, all that kind of stuff. But before Amos calls for justice to flow like righteousness, and before he makes his exhortation criticizing his community and what is wrong, first he invokes the beauties of creation. He speaks of God as the creator of the stars of night, of the heavens, of the earth, and as the provisioner of life. So the goodness of creation is the foundation or the backdrop for critiquing what is wrong, and the experienced goodness of life. And in that image of let justice roll down like waters, we have one of the primary images of how paradise is imagined as the source of the waters that give life to all creation. So yesterday in our first talk, we talked about the rivers of paradise, four rivers that flow out to give life to all the world. In the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel uses the imagery of paradise again to criticize empires that have betrayed the way of life that sustains the good gifts of life for all people. So the prophetic critique is a defense of paradise against the betrayal of paradise by unjust empires. So paradise is, the paradise garden functions as an anti-imperial image. For example, when Ezekiel condemns all sorts of empires. He goes on and on. I don't think he's found an empire that he likes. But when he's criticizing the fall of the kingdom of Tyre, he says, "You were the signet of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. You were on the holy mountain until iniquity was found in you. You were filled with violence. So I cast you as a profane thing from the mountain of God. I turned you to ashes on the earth." So the devastations and failures of empire are pictured as the abandonment or the exile, loss of paradise. But then Ezekiel also uses the images of paradise to speak about the promise of life. So the experience of the goodness of life also becomes the foundation of the promise of life for those who do justice and righteousness and who build communities that are right, in right relationship with the gifts of paradise. So when Ezekiel describes the restoration of Israel, in the restoration of Jerusalem on the mountain of God, and a mountain is another image for paradise because mountains are the source of the waters that bless all the earth. So the tops of mountains are where Basil the Great said you can always find paradise on the top of any mountain. That's why we have our Mount Rainier t-shirts on here. This is Paradise Meadows on Mount Rainier in Washington State. But Ezekiel promises the restoration of paradise in Jerusalem, and he does it by speaking of a great river that's going to well out from the temple in Jerusalem and give life to all the world. He says this river, everywhere the river goes, there will be life. And he says people will stand fishing on the banks of both sides of the river, and trees of every kind will grow there, and the fruit of the trees will be for the healing of the nations. So the gifts of paradise will come back into the world through just and righteous communities. Then you find this theme also in Isaiah, again Isaiah speaks of the call for the restoration of paradise, or the promise of the restoration of paradise comes through those who practice what could be called the ethics of paradise, of right relationship with earth and with one another through acts of justice and mercy and generosity and compassion. So we know these passages are so familiar, but listen to them through the Song of Songs as a backdrop, that erotic garden as the backdrop. Isaiah, says, loose the bonds of injustice, undo the thongs of the yoke, let the oppressed go free, bring the homeless poor into your house, offer your food to the hungry, and satisfy the needs of the afflicted. Then your light shall rise in the dawn, and you shall be like a paradise garden, like a spring whose waters never fail. So this promise in Isaiah that we ourselves will be and can be the restoration of the garden is also found in the words that Jesus himself uses to announce the beginning of his public ministry. So we say Jesus was a prophet of paradise. And the paradise language also is paralleled in the kingdom of God language or the city of God. These are similar images. The city of God is the city in which the paradise garden and the just community come together into one experience. So I'll just close this part with this passage. Again, so familiar from Isaiah, but notice how these words move again towards the promise of the garden. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted. They will be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, to display his glory. For as the earth brings forth its shoots, and as a garden causes what is sown in it to spring up, so the Lord God will cause righteousness and praise to spring up before all the nations.
So those of you that know Luke 4 probably recognize that Isaiah text as the scroll, Isaiah's scroll, from which Jesus reads to deliver what some people call his inaugural address, the speech that defines his ministry and life's work in the world. What's interesting is that if you think about what I said about the Hebrew Bible being structured by the story of the garden, all the things that go wrong in between, and the recovery of the garden, the New Testament also follows the very same pattern. So in Luke, you have the pattern in which Jesus stands up, reads this scroll about the restoration of the garden as the definition of his work in the world. And then he pauses and he says, today, this text has been fulfilled in your hearing. So he says, today, not after death, not tomorrow, not someday, but today. And all the way through Luke, he preaches the ethics of how to behave in the garden. All of those parables that we're so familiar with in the Gospel of Luke about, well, what is the kingdom of God like? Well, it's like this. This is the ethic we're supposed to live now, not someday. And the trajectory of his resistance to the Roman Empire finally lands in the crucifixion. And from there he says to the thief, today, and again the word today appears. So you have today in chapter 4, and today, as he is on the cross speaking to the thief, he says, today you will be with me in paradise. So that you have this sense of it's today, not some other time. So Luke has this beginning of the garden story and the end, the story, today you will be with me in paradise, and everything in between about the teaching and the protesting against the empire and all of that. The Gospel of John is even more explicit in following the Hebrew Bible order. And we all know in the beginning, and in Genesis is how John begins, in the beginning, again. It's like the recreation of the world. So the word is created. And so John, every biblical scholars all have talked about how John 1 is like Genesis 1. It's like the original creation of what's going to redeem the world now. But what's interesting is Genesis 2 begins with the story of the wedding at Cana.
John 2 begins
with the story of the wedding at Cana, which is the story of the fruits of the vineyard. Right? The wedding has happened off stage. The wedding has already happened, and now we're celebrating, and we've run out of wine, and his mother tells him to make more, and he says, no, not yet, and she says, yes, now. And he makes the wine. And so you have Genesis 1 and John 1, Genesis 2, the garden, John 2, the fruits of the garden. So you have this tracking in the Gospel of John. And then you have, in the middle of the Gospel, the contestation with Caesar, the contestation with the empire, and all the enemies that want to kill him, and his struggle, the power struggle that's happening, and his demonstration against his opposition to the temple exploitive system of the temple, which gets him killed. So at the end of the Gospel, after the crucifixion, after he's laid in his grave, you have this moment where Mary comes to the garden and she confuses Jesus with the gardener, in case you missed the point of where they were. They're back in the garden. And so you have at the end of John the garden with Jesus and Mary as the new male, new female in the garden, the restoration of the garden. And then you track through the entire New Testament, you get all the way to the book of Revelation, and there you have Ezekiel repeated. As many people that think that Revelation is a kind of commentary, repetition of the book of Ezekiel with the beasts and all the crazy visions and all of that, that Ezekiel has, you see this in Revelation. And in fact, in early Christian art, the beasts of Revelation, or that are also in Ezekiel, become the gospel writers. It's the same creatures. So sometimes they're the creatures from Revelation, and sometimes there's a gospel writers in the artwork, and the only way you can tell is if they're gospel writers, they're holding a codex. But you get this repetition of the Ezekiel sense of critique of empire, and the destruction of empire to ashes happening in Revelation as an echo, because of course in Revelation the bad empire is figuratively called Babylon. But at the end of the book of Revelation, you get the same vision you get in Ezekiel of the restoration of a holy city that actually is a good city that functions, that the rivers are like crystal. They're not polluted with oil and sewage, but these are beautiful rivers that run through the city, and there are trees with leaves for healing. And it's the same vision as you find. So the New Testament tracks in a similar pattern to the track of the Hebrew Bible as a restoration of the life of the garden that we all need to learn to live well on the earth, and to live out what God calls us to do, which is to resist protest, as these images, some of them are protest actions, to protest empire and to restore life on earth as it is in its best, but not as its perfection. It's really important to understand that in the early Christian understanding of paradise, it was not utopia. That's later, once it becomes the afterlife as a reward for killing. They have to make it sound as good as possible so people will fight to get there. But in the early church, it was actually this world. It was understood to be the world at its best, with all its imperfections and difficulties, that the baptism was delivery into the doors of paradise, that Jesus' resurrection in the garden had proved that he had reopened those doors, and that we were all welcome, and the baptism was the portal. And once we were here, our job was to take on the spirit of Christ that he left for us, so we become divine like Christ, which is why the Trinity is so important, because the third person of the Trinity is the church. The divinity, the third part of divinity. And then our job is to maintain life in paradise, because baptism, when we walk through the doors of paradise, we receive great power. We receive the power of the Holy Spirit. So we have to become wise. We have to live in paradise in a way that sustains it, and that's a journey into wisdom. And the New Testament and the Hebrew Bible both follow that journey into wisdom and power.
So as gifted human beings, blessed by the gifts of creation, we're called to work for the sustenance of creation. We're going to show you another video in a moment here, yeah. To pull this together. But one of the things that's so important about restoring our awareness of paradise as a central religious theme and as a reality of our lives is it gives us a different foundation for working for justice and peace in this world. Many of us work for justice and peace thinking we have to imagine the world as it should be, as if it were out there in the future, and we're going to try to bring into being the world that we think should exist. But this spirituality of paradise reverses that. We start with the experience of the goodness of life and of the gifts that we have received and the joys that we know. And those joys become the motivation, the resource that fuels our activism and our caring for life. It's to protect and defend the goodness of life, not to bring into being something that doesn't exist, but to care for the reality already here, this good world, this interdependent, diverse, complex, messy, beautiful garden of life that is ours. And it's refreshing and strengthening to reorient our spirituality to the joy and goodness of life that we are then protecting and defending and sharing. It's like what I started to learn from Rita 30 years ago. To be a religious person starts with taking joy in the gifts of life that God has given us.
And that there is great beauty in the world. For all the ways in which human civilizations have destroyed a lot of that beauty, there is still great beauty in the world. And that is what compels us to love the world, because the beauty of the world is not something we did. It's not something we earned. It's just a gift, and it's a call to love, and it gives us great joy. And that's not something we're going to envision and make. It's there. It's just there. And to be grounded in that love of the world, to be grounded in the sense of the gift of the beauty of life and the goodness and joy of life is the ethic that drives the commitment to sustain that world. Not something imaginary, but something quite real and still here. So we're going to play a little video. We're going to have time for discussion after this video. So if you want to talk about some of the things we've said, we'll have a little time to do that. That we're going to move to a video that has, we think, some of the sense of playfulness and joy.
Street, and we came across a little rose garden, very small rose garden.
Some compost and some flowers in the pavement.
Doesn't make me feel bad.
So it's a positive feeling.
Can see the lovely flower and you know the fruits growing with it. It's lovely.
All right, when I saw the plant, I did like it. It had nice color, and that's why I want to take it. I want to take it to my house.
Basically green with your for a red flower, then a yellow flower, really beautiful.
It was quite unusual to see a greenery in a concrete jungle like Brick Lane. It's quite nice.
The flowers are pretty, yeah. Green, not much of it, is the best thing to come in small packages, isn't it?
It's quite unusual because East London is very concrete-y, so when I saw it, I was quite surprised. It brightened up our day a little bit, because it is quite grey today, and the red of the flowers was really nice. I do want to touch it.
Refresh your mind, something natural, nature. We are the part of nature.
What have you got there? You've got a hyacinth. Is that a hyacinth?
It's a hyacinth.
There's
some snowdrops and pansies.
Yes, well, that's a bit of a change.
First of all, I thought it was natural, so I thought, well, that's really interesting, like the way nature finds its way, even in the urban world.
Though I did wonder whether maybe it just cropped up of its own accord, which was a nice thought, but possibly not the most realistic.
God didn't put them there, but he gave us the will to put them there. There you go.
I suppose it might highlight how much we use cars instead of walking and public transport.
I see that more as a kind of street art, more as an aesthetic intervention rather than an awareness of a pothole.
I'd be interested, who did it and why? Why someone planted a small garden in the pothole? I think that someone might want to plant a small garden in a pothole because they might want to make a point that this is actually an unnecessary thing, it might be also to beautify the city.
It is very pretty, and I hope it will be left there, that they won't go over it with their flipper car.
I don't think the length of the life of the garden would be the problem. I suppose it would be more the way it might meet its end. So if it was going to be constantly run over by cars, it would be a little bit sad, I suppose.
Well, at least we can see it's more visible when you're driving or anything. Yeah.
I think a better way of highlighting a pothole would be a big lump of something really nasty. Flowers. Don't think flowers would work, mate. We need metal spikes and chains for London. Flowers won't work.
We're ready for comments or remarks.
Want to read? Want to turn to talk to each other for a few minutes?
Sure. Maybe you should, the person you introduced yourself to at the beginning, turn and comment.
We have about 10 minutes left, so we can take some questions from the roving microphone.
Yeah, we'll take some questions in a moment, but just share,
With each other, and then we'll citizens. Have a conversation.
For just a few moments.
I should read this. Read that. Hey. Clap three times if you can hear me. Okay, comments, questions, responses.
And he has the mic here.
Ideas.
The relationship of paradise now to paradise to come?
The relationship of paradise now to paradise to come is that the paradise to come is also in this realm of paradise now. And there's a thin veil between the world that we live in and the world where the dead live. And that thin veil is a veil that Satan or the serpent cannot cross through. So when we die, we go to this resting place because we don't have to struggle with the serpent anymore. And because we can rest,
we can help the living. And so the ancient world understood the paradise of the dead to be coterminous with the paradise of the living, and that at every Eucharist feast, the dead came, so that the Eucharist feast was the gathering of the great cloud of witnesses living and dead. And it was hosted by the living Christ, who also came to host the feast. And so when we dream of the dead, when we have visions of the dead, when we think of the dead, they're nearby. That's the paradise to come.
And it's an origin. A great theologian of the early church, Origen, said the dead come to the Eucharist feast even more quickly than the living. So they're already in the space when we arrive, and they're with us.
And just as a little trivia factoid, the only major theologian of the early church that believed the dead did not visit in dreams. He didn't say the dead didn't visit at all, but he didn't believe that the dead visited in dreams at all, was Augustine, because his mother had never visited him. Really, he said that.
Oh, okay, thank you. He's watching over.
I wanted to say thank you for this theology, and also, I don't know about anybody else, but I feel very inspired to take action in small scale, renovate the garden that we have, do urban gardening, all these things. And at the same time, I feel like I don't know enough about gardening. And I, that is exactly the reaction that I want to get, or I think that you give the reaction that I want to get, is I feel there's a generational gap of knowledge that people in generations before me, and luckily, a lot of them are still alive, know much more about these things. And I really want to challenge all of the people in my generation to go and seek that wisdom, and also challenge people who have that wisdom to actually make it accessible. And I think that will greatly benefit the church.
Thank
Wonderful.
You.
Amazing.
It's actually one of the great gifts of the church is that these are intergenerational communities, so, and no one has to do it by themselves.
Well, I'd like to just follow that up by saying that I have been extremely blessed 20 years ago to be able to leave London and to renovate an old farm. It's a small holding. And if you don't know anything, it's possible, because you could become a woofer, a willing worker on organic farm. And you don't have to know anything. I didn't know very much, and I have learnt. But I wanted to just make one more comment, if I may, about the healing, the leaves of the trees for the healing of the nations. After 20 years now, or for the last 10, I've had young offenders and people from psychiatric units who come, and they just find peace and healing from doing things with the animals, planting things. So it is possible, and it's wonderful. So I live in paradise.
Oh, did you see the woman in the back?
Yeah.
Okay, so these will be the last two, I think. We're running out of time.
Okay, really enjoyed it. Again, Reed and Rebecca. I mean, on that expert, I was sitting next to Professor John Bryant here, who's a professor of botany at Exeter University, so we might well be able to put something up on the internet there. Could I just touch on that paradise now, paradise to come things? I'm totally get the Jesus saying today and how to live ethically today, but then when he says things like, I go to prepare a place for you, there are many mansions in my Father's house, does that still square with what you're saying about this thin veil between the living and the dead?
I think there's what happens to the dead was a crucial question when you had a 2/3 infant mortality rate and life expectancy was 25. And only 7% of the population lived above the age of 40. It isn't that death, the early deaths didn't make them love each other less. It just made them want to be close to those they'd lost. So that there's a sense that there will be a place prepared for the dead, that there will be a good place for them, that they will be cared for, and that they will be close. What I think was a comforting thing. And it's actually quite common in most cultures for people to experience the dead returning. I think, in fact, the resurrection appearances are about that.
Let me just add to this that in addition to the early death, there were also the deaths caused by the empires, by the oppressive systems. And, of course, Jesus was killed by an empire that wanted to stop his movement and to suppress the resistance of the Jewish people to Roman rule. And under situations of oppression, affirmation of the resurrection of the dead was a very powerful affirmation and experience that no matter what the principalities and powers do to try to suppress or destroy life or to privilege some and leave many others in poverty and hunger or to violate the earth, that the creativity of God as the source of life is more powerful than those principalities and powers. And life, as the old Psalms say, victory remains with life. And when St. Paul argues, in 2 Corinthians, when the question is asked of St. Paul, how do we know the dead will be raised? How do we know that? And Paul makes an argument for life after death by asking people to observe the world here and now. He said, look at the plants. Look at how when you plant a seed, it changes form, but there's another life form that comes. And then he says, everything in creation has a different form. There are many bodies and many forms of beauty. The stars have one kind of beauty, and the sun another kind, and the planets, and even they differ from one another. So it will be with the resurrection of the dead. So the affirmation of resurrection comes for St. Paul as an out of an observation of the fecundity, creativity, and beauty of the world in its ever-shifting forms. And so the paradise to come, life after death, is another expression of paradise now, paradise as we know.
And so we'll take one more question, and then we have somebody coming in at 12:30. We want to respect their time.
Hello, I too would like to thank you for the presentation, particularly for showing us all this beauty. This is one of the most beautiful things I've seen all weekend. I work in a prison, and I think it's struck me so forcibly just now how much we punish people, not just by depriving them of liberty, but by depriving them of beauty. And perhaps in our work in prisons and in our chapels, perhaps one of the things I will try and go out to do is make my chapel a place of beauty, to bring the boys back to beauty again. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is one of the best ways we can heal the world.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent. Yeah.
It's great. When we chose this image, we just thought it was an interesting, playful image, but we didn't realize it was going to be a picture of Greenbelt this year. we want to close by reading together a very famous passage from the Song of Songs. Rebecca's going to give us a quote from Rumi before we do that.
Yes, and it builds on just what you said. Creating beauty and responding to beauty is one of the most important things we can do to heal the world. And Rumi said, let the beauty we know become the good we do. So let our good actions follow from our gratitude for beauty and are drinking deeply of beauty. So we want to close with all of us reading together these lines.
If you can see these words up here.
From the Song of Songs.
So let's read together.
Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is strong as death, passion fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of a raging flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown.
Amen. And go in beauty.
Not even the floods of Greenbelt. Thank you.